Love this podcast? Support this show through the Acast Supporter feature. It's up to you how much you give and there's no regular commitment. Just hit the link in the show description to support now.
Mom deserves the best, and there's no better place to shop for Mother's Day than Whole Foods Market. They're your destination for unbeatable savings, from premium gifts to show-stopping flowers and irresistible desserts. Start by saving 33% with Prime on all body care and candles. Then get a 15-stem bunch of tulips for just $9.99 each with Prime. Round out Mom's menu with festive rosé, irresistible berry chantilly cake, and more special treats. Come celebrate Mother's Day at Whole Foods Market.
Mother's Day is around the corner. Find the perfect gift for the mom in your life with a stunning piece of jewelry from Blue Nile. From timeless pearls to dazzling gemstones, Blue Nile has something she'll adore. Need it fast? Most items can ship overnight. Plus, enjoy guaranteed free shipping and returns. Don't miss our special Mother's Day deals. Save big on the season's most beautiful trends. For a limited time, get up to 50% off by going to BlueNile.com. That's BlueNile.com.
Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Cats and cat owners deserve better than any old-fashioned litter. That's why I teamed up with scientists and veterinarians to create Pretty Litter. Its innovative crystal formula has superior odor control and weighs up to 80% less than clay litter. Pretty Litter even monitors health by changing colors to help detect early signs of potential illness. It's the world's smartest kitty litter.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code ACAST for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.
This is Writers on Film, the only podcast dedicated to books on cinema. Hello, everybody, and welcome to Writers on Film. My name is John Bleasdale. I'm a writer and film critic, and I'm joined today by another writer and film critic, podcaster as well, an author. His name is Kai Ross, and he is, along with his friend Chris
Bainbridge.
He is a co-host and author of the book Free for All, which is a episode-by-episode guide of The Prisoner, the sort of cult British TV show starring Patrick McGoohan. And I've wanted to have Chris on the show for a long time because it's one of those shows which fascinates me, and I've loved, and I think I found it about the same time as you did, the early 90s, when they were repeating it on, I think, on Channel 4. Is that right?
It was, yeah. It was the 25th anniversary, and it was the 25th anniversary of all things 1967. So I'd sort of just Sergeant Pepper and the Summer of Love and everything. So it was absolutely everywhere, documentaries made and all these sort of things. But we'd been primed a little bit. There was a show called, do you remember a show called TV Heaven?
Yes.
It was a sort of clips. Well, not a clip show so much. It was just Frank Muir. When it was really, it was a very easy job for Frank, bless him. He would just stand there and go, hello, this was in 1967, this was made. And it was a lot of basically shows from each year. I remember the 1967 one had Do Not Adjust Your Set, the sort of pre-Python thing.
Right, with David Frost.
Yes, yeah. So Channel 4 would sort of put on these things. And then it was the last ever one, and they showed The Prisoner. And the episode they chose was The Girl Who Is Death. And if you're a Prisoner fan, you'll know that you couldn't have picked a less representative episode, because it was a sort of one of these, literally had absolutely nothing to do with the rest of the series. He wasn't in the village, it was a story, but it was fantastic.
Yeah, it's almost like a bottle episode, the opposite of a bottle episode. It's like not in the bottle, you know, it's outside of the bottle.
Yeah, but it was just, I'd never seen anything like it. And it had sort of been in the air, the whole prisoner thing had started, the sort of the cult thing had developed, I think, from about the mid-80s onwards. Because it kind of had a sort of stink of, not failure, it was just sort of, because of the ending, the last episode was so sort of divisive. And then it sort of went away a little bit. And then it started to find the right audience. And then by they showed it again in 1982, and then it suddenly became this big thing. So I'd heard about it, and I, Chris and I, we both live about an hour away from Port Merion. And so my mum's saying, oh, it was only up the road. And so when we started watching it, I couldn't believe that it was literally within an hour's drive. And it just suddenly very, very quickly became this big obsession. So wearing the badge and everything.
So when did you visit Port Merion?
Oh, I think that's almost immediately, that as soon as we could. The Christmas of 1992, I think, when it was still being shown. And they had a sort of gift shop there. There's a sort of, in number 6's old house, it's still kind of there then, but it was the prisoner shop. And of course, they had these, they're the thing. There was a thing in The Girl Who Was Deaf. He drinks a pint. Do you remember this? And then you can just about see something on the bottom of the glass, and he has to sort of down the pint to sort of to see this thing that's saying, you've just been poisoned. And they are brilliant. Oh, no, it's absolutely wonderful. But they were selling these stickers to put on the bottom of pint glasses, and which is highly irresponsible.
Yeah, and somebody going to the hospital immediately after.
Having a stomach pump? Oh, just with the mischief makers from the prisoner circle. But got loads of those pens and stuff. So it was always a beeline to go there. But I mean, as a place itself, it's there's nothing like it on Earth.
And what's the history of the place? Was it some sort of industrialist, benevolent sort of industrialist, or?
Oh, I don't know about his kind of extra architectural sort of past, but he was a fellow called Clough Williams Ellis, who was a master of the +4, wonderful sock wearing gentleman, and I think it was his land. I'm not sure, but he wanted to create an Italianate village. But his kind of brief to himself was that he wanted to create a sort of a village that would basically work within the natural environments that it was already in. It would enhance the natural beauty of what it was, as opposed to sort of fitting in a weird way. And he used to basically he'd call it a home for fallen buildings. It was he put the word out, and if anyone, you know, there's a sort of a colonnade from Bristol that they were about to put the wrecking ball through. No, send it up. So he sort of, all these things are about to be destroyed. He'd sort of no, ship them up to Port Merion, and he'd factor them into the village. So it's a lot of it's kind of almost secondhand buildings, but it's because of the Italianate thing. Very quickly, it started to get used as an Italian setting, which it does in Danger Man. You see all these places.
It's an earlier Patrick McGoohan show.
It is, yes, which I'm discussing with Chris tomorrow, in fact, for our Christmas show. But you'd get that a lot. You'd see these old ITC shows, and so usually Warren Mitchell walking around in a moustache, saying, Signor Templar, you're here. And after some stock footage of the Colosseum, and you thought, I know that place, it's Port Merion. But it was obviously cheaper than flying them out there.
It's like the later series of The Persuaders, where there's the stock footage of Cannes, and then they're very obviously in Coventry afterwards.
I think The Persuaders, they actually went there. There was just the budget-eating travel thing. They said, no, let's shoot there and use real champagne. You can see Tony Curtis and Roger Moore getting fatter and fatter with each... I don't know, using real champagne.
Well, that's a show that deserves a podcast in itself.
Surely. Yes. I loved all that. It was, do you remember, it was just in the early 90s, maybe they just needed slots to fill, but all those ITC shows started to just come back.
Man with a Suitcase was another one. I remember the Man with a Suitcase, they showed all those. And the other one that was great is a slightly different, it's not an ITC show, it's an American show. But, and I've got a real hankering to rewatch this, Crime Story, the Michael Mann, Dennis Farina-led show. That was absolutely brilliant. And I kind of haven't seen it. And I actually recently looked on for the DVD, because I thought that's a box set I'd eat, you know, quite happily eat with a knife and fork. And I couldn't find it. It was like imports only. And, you know, there wasn't like $150 or something like that. It was very, very tricky to find.
Yeah. I don't remember it being on TV, but I remember seeing it in video shops.
Mm.
It was that classy. And I just remember Dennis Farina's kind of mustachioed sort of snarl sort of staring out to the covers. But there were loads of them as well. I can't remember.
Buffalo Bill from Silence of the Lambs is a recurring character in it. The actor, exactly, Ted Levine, the actor, is a recurring character.
He's ace.
Amazing, amazing stuff. Is she a big fat girl? So Patrick McGoohan, what about the sort of like origin of the show? Because this is a show that as you talk about in the book and on the podcast, is very much sort of Patrick McGoohan's baby.
Yeah. Well, it started his, the guy who produced it with him, or produced it for George Markstein. He was the one who came up with the idea. He'd heard of these places, basically holiday camps, where they would retire spies. And that whole concept, I mean, there was one called, Inver Lodge or something in Scotland. Mm. And it was a genuine thing. They would actually sort of get these spies who were at retirement age, and you go and stay here. And I think McGoohan just thought, what a brilliant concept. And I think Markstein wanted to do something a little bit more grounded and more like Le Carré. Whereas I think McGoohan started to think, it started to sort of think outside the box a little bit. And then obviously the idea of that you couldn't escape, and it had took on that slightly more science fiction-y edge. But it was a sort of, it was just created by various people. And I think McGoohan was the one who just kind of went further with it. But he had a whole good crew from the Danger Man days. David Tomlin was his partner. And he was a fantastic, he became like the greatest assistant director the world's ever known. But I've been watching a lot of Danger Man for the podcast, and you just see these same recurring names in the credits. But I think it was certainly by the end of it, it was absolutely McGoohan's opus. It became something of an obsession. I think he drove himself a little bit mad taking on all the responsibility for doing it as well.
And perhaps, you know, well, actually, let's come to the ending later, because it's, I don't want to jump the gun, so to speak. So I think that generic thing, it seems to be resonant of where it is historically as well, that Le Carré sort of anti-James Bond ordinariness doesn't quite fit into where they are in the 1960s, as you say. You know, Sergeant Pepper's Lonely Hearts Club Band, 1967. You have a feel that they want this to be a metaphor. They want it to be Kafka. They want it to be science fiction. They want it to be a whole load of things.
Yeah, but I think, I mean, also Danger Man, watching a lot of the Danger Man stuff, that really does have a lot of Le Carré in it. That's from the same sort of school. Obviously, it's not as dour as The Spy Who Came In from the Cold, but you can tell that they're being sort of made in the same era, particularly the first tranche that were half an hour. It's a very different sort of titles. It's like very, very black and white. And then obviously suddenly you're into color, and it's just like there are in fact only two Danger Man episodes they made in color, and the whole tone shifts completely. And The Prisoner is very much in color, and it's the whole attitudes change then, but it's still, I think, it's trying to be anti various things. It's desperately not trying to be James Bond. It's not trying to be, it's trying to sort of go away from the curve, I think.
And again, I mean, I know you mentioned, I don't want to make too much of the Sergeant Pepper connection, but it has that 60s thing of sort of going through Victorian junk shops and Edwardian, you know, it's got the, you know, the penny farthing, and it's got the vintage car that he drives around. Yeah, and even you know, everybody looking like they're from a croquet party at the village.
Yeah, it's a very sort of rather not even British, very English thing, isn't it? But you're right, absolutely Edwardian, Arcadia, Victorian stuff. It was everywhere then, wasn't it? I think talked about this with Chris. It was a sort of rediscovery of that Lennon, the Beatles, all these artists were sort of going back to their childhood a lot, weren't they? And they were starting to rediscover things like Alice in Wonderland and Wind in the Willows. And then suddenly there was, and Pink Floyd were very big on this, weren't they? With the Sid Barrett stuff.
Which was, let's face it, the best stuff Pink Floyd did. That's my, that'll be my, my contention. I'll happily fight you with broken bottles. Bike was the peak of.
No, bike was ace. Absolutely, yeah. No, it is. It's wonderful. The many stages.
Yes, but, yes.
But no, it's absolutely at the peak of that, possibly for the 1967 stuff, which of course they were making in 1966. And then by the sort of second half of the series in sort of 67, 68, the mood is sort of changed. It was actually getting away from that. It was getting just a little bit, but it was just not sort of peak 60s. It was peak 67, peak May 67. You know, it was so specific. Mm. It was wonderful. It was very much à la mode.
I wonder as well if something to do with its reputation and the way it had to be sort of rediscovered in the 90s and rediscovered by different generations, rather than it just always being in our consciousness like other shows from the period. I mean, partly it's to do with just the fact it didn't continue. There weren't other iterations. But also maybe partly it was to do with Patrick McGoohan's career, that he didn't sort of go on to movie superstardom. So it wasn't like, oh, did you ever see what he did on TV in the 60s? You know, in the way said Roger Moore, people would go back and watch The Saint, or because Roger Moore then was in James Bond.
Yeah, it was interesting. I don't really know why. I mean, famously, he sort of stepped out of The Prisoner for about 6 months to make Ice Station Zebra, or Zebra. I'm going to say Zebra.
Yeah. I mean, it's an American film, so I'm not sure what the pronunciation would be.
I'll go with Zebra then, if it's American.
Yeah. It's a British novel, because it's Alistair MacLean.
I'm going to go back to Zebra then.
Who was American?
Zebra. Going back to Ice Station Zebra, it was... he stole the show in that. I mean, it was Rock's thing and Borgnine and Jim Brown. But everyone was talking about how great Patrick McGoohan was in this thing. You think, well, and it was a huge hit.
Mm.
And yet he didn't quite... I don't know if it was a deliberate thing, or I don't know if The Prisoner burnt him out, but he didn't... You're right, he didn't have that sort of secondary 70s thing that... I mean, Roger Moore, I suppose... He did have the Bond thing, but he was still making pretty big films outside of Bond. But I guess McGoohan never had that big secondary burst as a movie star as opposed to a TV star. Mm. Despite the fact, I mean, he did. I mean, there's still these wonderful performances, obviously, Escape from Alcatraz.
Right, yes, of course. He plays a sort of sadistic warden of the jail.
Yeah, which is a wonderful twist that the ultimate prisoner has become the ultimate warden. But he was great. He was great in that as well.
Yeah, I mean, he was in, of course, the other thing, and I think you cover this in several episodes of the podcast, that his Columbo appearances.
Mm.
And he was good friends with Peter Falk as well.
Yes, I think they both enjoyed a dram. But they were also, they saw in each other a sort of a brother figure who kind of they could sort of go up against the networks. Because Peter Falk, you've interviewed, you did Shooting Columbo on one of your rights on film. And he was warring with the networks all the time. And I think with McGoohan, he saw somebody else who would quite happily just kind of go, no, I'm not taking any of and just wouldn't accept any of their nonsense. And they were, and you know, and who both took it very, very, very seriously. I think Peter Falk, you know, he was an artist. He wasn't. He desperately wanted to make these things as good as they could possibly be. And McGoohan was the same. So I think they had a lot in common. And I think also McGoohan, for all his this is my thing, he worked well with like minds, like David Tomlin, like. Yeah, Peter Falk. I think he kind of worked better as a duo or as part of a team. And he did. He wasn't just in them. He directed a lot of those. He rewrote a lot of his episodes. So he was a big part of Columbo. I think Peter Falk's, whenever he got the chance, he'd sort of go on about how great Pat was.
One of the great points I love from David Koenig's book, and yeah, the episode we did on Writers and Film was brilliant, Shooting Columbo. I think it's called The History of TV's Most Rumpled Detective. I love one of the stories is that he did whenever he'd come back from a John Cassavetes movie, he'd do Husbands or he'd do Woman on a what's it called? Woman Under the Influence. I was almost going to say that. Yes. I was going to say that. So I channeled that mistake into you. I projected it onto you. Woman Under the Influence. When he'd come back from filming one of those, he would want to transfer that into Columbo. He'd go, let's just improvise scenes. I don't want to go with a script. I want to improvise scenes. And they'd be like, but this is a really carefully constructed teleplay where we need the audience to know information. Otherwise, it won't make sense because it's about an intricate crime and you detecting it. And he was like, he didn't care. He just wanted to, you know, to have it. He wanted that honesty in the TV shows. And it goes with what Patrick McGoohan was quite happy to do, I think, with The Prisoner, was have real ambitions above and beyond what I think other people were expecting.
Oh, yeah, very much so. That was great. He used to do sort of just endless takes. And it's like, this is a TV show piece. We don't do endless takes. We do two.
Absolutely.
And, he had Cassavetes in one of them as well. Etude in Black, and I think Ben Gazzara actually directed my favourite episode, Friend Indeed.
Is that the one where they're on the cruise ship?
He directed that one as well.
With
Robert Vaughn.
That's right. Wearing the amazing red sort of a black suit with he looks like Benicio del Toro in The Usual Suspects. It looks amazing in that. And that's one of those where you learn a fact from a Columbo episode, which is it's a really throwaway line where it's a feather and they say, oh, well, maybe it came from a pillow. And he goes, oh, no, they don't. They have foam pillows in a medical place because of allergies. And you just go, how the hell did you know that? And plus, I'm going to memorize that forever. I'm always going to remember that fact. What was the other Ben Gazzara episode?
Ben Gazzara was a friend indeed. It's one where he plays with it a little bit. It's the chief commissioner is the baddie. It's got a real sort of grittiness to it, which sometimes you don't get in Columbo's. They can, you know, more grittier than and the baddie. I forget his name, Richard Kiley. It doesn't even try to make friends with him first. There's none of this kind of sort of jocular sort of to and fro's between them. He's Columbo's his subordinate, and he makes no attempt to sort of befriend him at all. And so by the time he sort of gets him in one of the greatest gotchas. It's such a wonderful sort of you deserve this.
Yeah. I'm going through them at the moment, and I think I'm on season 4 at the moment. I'm just sort of treating myself to a Columbo every 2 weeks, and it warms the heart how good they are. There's such quality TV. You know, there's room in your screening schedule for one, you know, great sort of crime series.
Well, there's a channel over here. I don't know if you get it, but they every Sunday that's all they put on. So it's just almost impossible to miss them.
Right.
But it's it does. I mean, I don't have that kind of time in my life, alas. But that sounds like a perfect day, just not getting up. It's nothing but Columbo just endlessly all day.
Just ration yourself one every 2 weeks.
Just suddenly think about it. That's just gorging. You need to ration these things.
Yeah, because otherwise you start to see the strings and you start to see the repetitions and you start to see, oh, I see what they're doing there. And also because that's how they made them. They made them kind of quite. Rarely they would have like a year in between seasons and things like that, so they would spend a lot of time on them, as you were saying, that there's a lot of care spent on them.
Yeah, and they were made by really good, I think Jonathan Demme directed a couple, sort of big, a bit like The Prisoner actually. They had and also Danger Man. You start to see these directed by. And a lot of these things, Charles Crichton, Seth Holt, you know, these are, wow, my God, these are proper movie makers. You know, there's a reason these things look so good. And Don Chaffee, who directed the first, I don't know, well, I mean, they were spread across, but I think the first tranche of episodes, he directed it. He was a pretty Jason and the Argonauts. He directed A Million Years BC. He was a big. He was used to sort of creating massive widescreen epics, and it shows. You know, a lot of TV when it's directed by, journeyman, to use sort of you can kind of tell, or people who are actually used to just making television shows. When you actually started to bring in more cinematic eyes, it definitely showed.
I always thought that bit of him running across the beach and getting caught by the bouncing ball is like, that always struck me as something that wasn't televisual. That was something that felt like a movie, you know?
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
You know, there's just something about that image was much more graphic and much more, cinematic. You know?
Oh, I agree. And it was very handy. You can tell the episodes that were actually shot there as opposed to... Because they would basically shoot as much as they possibly could on set or at Port Merion. And then a lot of the time they would have to go to Boreham Wood where they'd shoot the interiors, and they would have these cloths with pictures of Port Merion on the background. And you could kind of tell. But the ones that were there, because there was no sort of, well, if we turn the camera this way, we'll see the gaffer eating a sandwich at the edge of the stage. You know, so we've got this kind of limited amount of camera space. You could just turn it anywhere. And there's an episode, Dance of the Dead. Do you remember that one? With Mary Morris as number two, and it's just like and there's this spectacular shot or scene set on the beach with the tides out, and they're having this chat, this sort of interrogation, sort of number six and Mary Morris, and it just looks, you're just watching this. This isn't telly. This is something much, much more going on here. And also in the editing as well, that first episode, Arrival, when he arrives, there are scenes where he's looking around, he sees somebody in a clock tower, and he sort of runs up and there's nobody there, and then he goes down. But it's the way it's edited is very, very unusual for TV at that time. Again, it's the kind of thing you would expect us to be sort of watching in a cinema.
I mean, there's talking about that thing that you were saying earlier in terms of things were changing, 1967 May, and how specific it is, and how we're going away from the hippies, and we're going away from that. There is a sort of pessimism to there is a sort of spikiness to the. It's not. It is a fun show. There's a lot of humor and all the rest of it, but it's not a fun show. It's not an easy watch. It's always kind of disturbing. It's always kind of prickly, you know, a bit like McGoohan's own character.
Yeah. I mean, it's designed in the, I think we mentioned this in a book, it's a bit like The Fugitive, in as much as he can't leave. Mm. So he's doomed to lose at the end of every episode. So it's going to have that sort of, not so much downbeat, but he has kind of little mini victories. There are a couple of them where he sort of, like, there's one of the great episodes, Hammer into Anvil, where he reduces Patrick Cargill to a dribbling mess by sort of driving him mad and making him resign. And it's like, yes, you won. Well, he's still a prisoner. But and other ones where he's sort of with this, almost like a draw. But ultimately, he's got to lose at the end of every single episode. And I think in terms of what he was trying to sort of get at in the metaphor of it, of what he was trying to sort of say, he was being very challenging. I don't think he was being optimistic much. I think, we'll talk about the ending in a while. I think it's a sort of, this is what we need to do. But I think it's undercut by a sort of sense that, but I bet we're not going to do this though. Mm. We are sort of, to a certain extent, doomed. It's a kind of, if we only do this, if we only sort of start changing and doing this, we'll get through this. Mm. Well, I don't think we will. So it's that sort of, it's kind of what I mean about the sort of the optimism of 1967, and then the sort of kind of the increasing sense of doom of 1968. You know, they're two very different years in terms of what we're about to, where we're at.
For me, it was always, while I was watching it, there was always a sense of this absent number one, that you had the number twos were always changing. The number six was him, and he was always asking, who's number one? Who's number one? And it was almost like there was, I remember once I was teaching Citizen Kane to some of my students, and we were discussing it. They'd watched it and we were discussing it. And someone said to me, spoiler for Citizen Kane, Rosebud, it's meaningful, but it's not explanatory. And I thought, that's really interesting. That's such an interesting distinction. I know what you mean. It does mean something. But when you think about it, it doesn't really. I mean, if you're saying it explains everything, then it's kind of very trite as a film. You know, he became a big media mogul because they took away his sled. You know, it's sort of like which symbolized his childhood and blah 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 blah. But if it means something a bit more poetic and resonant and you can't quite pin it down, then I get it. And the same is sort of true of number one. Is it like, what is this thing? Oh, it's just you. You know, could be quite a trite way of going forward. But the fact that number one is sort of the power behind everything and it doesn't, you know, it's more a force than it is an individual.
Yeah. And I guess, I mean, another spoiler alert. I mean, after everyone thinking, oh, it's going to be the butler or it's going to be this, it turns out that it was actually, in an extraordinarily edited brief scene, it turns out to be himself. But in exactly the same way, no, that isn't himself. It's just by this point in this particular episode, everything is a metaphor. It's not even vaguely a spy show by the final episode, but that barely scratches the surface of what that actually means, or what that even suggests, that you're your own prisoner or something. You can sort of reduce it to slightly sort of something as trite as that, like we are our own worst enemy. That's what it's all about. But it's I mean, we could talk about that for hours and hours and hours and hours. But and again, that's kind of what the hope, the element of hope that I was sort of talking about. They said, well, if you actually accept that, then there's probably something you can sort of take control of yourself a little bit. But I think without saying, it's all everybody else's fault. No, it's mine. It's me. I'm the one who's still in bed at noon.
Yeah, but I mean, like, that ending was, I mean, what, how was that received? Was it was you know, because I haven't looked into this as deeply as you have. I obviously saw it as the ending, and to me in the 1990s it felt of a piece with the whole show and crazy AF, as the kids say, but not necessarily not necessarily wildly out of,
well, it was, I think, because there were so many, so it was doing very, very well. It was a big, the numbers for its viewing figures were in the tens of millions. So it was still a big show. It wasn't designed to be a little cult show. It was designed to be a big primetime thing. So all in the papers, who's number one? Da, 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 da. Oh, we're going to find out. So it was a big deal. And everyone was literally expecting a chair to turn around and it would be Orson Welles stroking a cat or something like that. And it was just like, and then it was, what was it? And no one can understand it. And it gets a little bit apocryphal at this point. You know, apparently Magoon was chased from the country. People were sort of, the ITV switchboard just basically caught fire, and pitchforks and torches and all that sort of stuff. But it was certainly designed specifically to not to be controversial, but to sort of get everyone sort of reacting, whether that was kind of, how dare you? I've sat through 17 hours of this. I wanted Roger Moore to be number one. You've denied me. Or people just going, oh, genius, brilliant. So I knew it was going to be him all along. And little things like, you know, in the opening titles every week, it says, who are you? I can't remember how it says now, but... I can't remember. There was a sort of hiding in plain sight bit of dialogue, brain is.
Well, maybe even it's a sort of, who is number one? You are number six. You know, sort of.
That's
like,
exactly what it is. Yeah, you, comma, all that sort of stuff. So it was. I mean, it was newsworthy. It was in all the papers the following day and everything. My God, what's he done? But and I think that's exactly what McGowan wanted to do. I think he desperately didn't want some passive sort of, oh right, great. Oh, what's on BBC Two now?
Yeah, exactly.
He wanted everyone.
The end of the Truman Show, that's got to be one of the best endings of a film ever.
Isn't it brilliant? Yeah.
Yeah.
See that, John?
Yeah. That's whatever the great drama is about the Truman Show, everybody will just turn over. It's not like, no, it's not going to be the end of the world. Exactly. You know?
And if you ask Chris Bainbridge, he'll say, because there was, I don't know if you, it's best to pretend it never happened, but there was an actual remake of The Prisoner.
Jim Caviezel.
Jim Catweasel is in. And it was all a sort of dream and a big pharma thing. Forget it. If you ask Chris, the best remake ever of The Prisoner was The Truman Show. It's like if you were going to do it now, you know, in an age of 24-hour rolling TV and all that sort of stuff, that is exactly what The Prisoner is.
Mother's Day is around the corner. Find the perfect gift for the mom in your life with a stunning piece of jewelry from Blue Nile. From timeless pearls to dazzling gemstones, Blue Nile has something she'll adore. Need it fast? Most items can ship overnight. Plus, enjoy guaranteed free shipping and returns. Don't miss our special Mother's Day deals. Save big on the season's most beautiful trends. For a limited time, get up to 50% off by going to BlueNile.com. That's BlueNile.com.
Hey there, it's Michelle Norris. I'm host of a podcast called Your Mama's Kitchen. When I travel, I'm usually looking for a way to find a taste of home when I'm not at home. And one of the things I love to do when I am at home is entertain. And Airbnb allows me to do that. When I was in California recently, I rented a house that had a great kitchen. And when we were sitting around the table, we're all thinking, we're in someone else's house. Someone could be in all of our homes as well. If you have a home, but you're not always at home, you have an Airbnb. Your home might be worth more than you think. Find out how much at airbnb.com/host.
How do you stand on the sort of, you know, okay, it's a metaphor. Do you feel there are metaphors and analogies which are sort of like coherent? I know I read Alex Cox's book. I think you had him on as a guest, didn't you?
We did, yes. That was eight.
And he's got a very... I might have even put you in touch with him, if I remember rightly. He's got a very specific theory about what The Prisoner is, and it's like, that's it. It's the British nuclear arms program, the independent nuclear attempt to get an independent weapon.
I think he's a rocket scientist,
right? Yeah, exactly.
I think that the whole thing is like all these clues that have been sort of laced through the whole thing. There's it turns out, and then at the end, of course, the number one is housed within a big rocket with the word one on it. Mm. He's a rocket scientist, and it was like, okay, all right. But it didn't really seem to explain anything else. But I mean, what I love about The Prisoner is that you can go, well, oh yeah, that's what I think it is. Well, brilliant. I'm not 100% sure you're right, but whatever I think is, you're welcome to disagree with it as well. I think that's what's given its longevity. If it was about a specific thing, I think if McGowan just said, the whole thing is about my reluctance to join the common market. You go, oh, right, that's what it was all about. All right. And it would just immediately cease being interesting.
So you're saying he's a Brexiteer, then? You're saying it's
No, certainly not. the other thing, because McGowan is very ambiguous. You don't really, you don't really know where his colours are on what his master is. You know, he was never particularly in interviews. He never sort of gave the game away, but he was very sort of gnomic and sort of cryptic about everything. I think the only thing he was very specific about was the whole thing about the penny farthing, and that he was very anti, well, not so much anti, he was just very wary of the way that we were developing in terms of technology far too quickly. We were progressing. This was being invented. Well, we'll get this now. And then it was, and then something else. But we'd never actually stop and go, is this helping or hurting us? we just kind of take it on board instantly. And then we were being overwhelmed by it, and we were being overwhelmed by a technology we didn't quite understand. And I think that's, he was, with everything else, he was kind of, well, why don't you bring your own thing to it? You know, and with that, he was like, no, this is, we are progressing too quickly.
That's so funny. I've never thought about how long the penny farthing actually probably was in, you know, was it like the BlackBerry of bicycles? Like it had a brief 5-year stint where everybody rode around in penny farthings, and then someone said, why don't we have two equally large wheels and maybe not so large? And the penny, and it was like, no, penny farthing monthly was like the letters page. We're like, no, this is rubbish. We want our big wheels.
10 years later, all the hipsters still driving penny farthings. your equally shaped wheel nonsense. What a weird, isn't it a strange thing? You said, why didn't you first go with two wheels of exactly the same size? It's not like if you tried that first and it didn't work. Well, how about if we made the front one 5 times the size of the back one? It was,
yeah.
I'd love to be in there at the sort of design meetings when how they came up with that as the first idea.
Yeah, there's a great writer who once mentioned the idea that we've had wheels for years and we've had luggage for years, but it was only like 20 years ago somebody said, wait, why don't we put wheels on our luggage? You know, I mean, he's like, instead of carrying them around all the time, why don't we just put them on the bottom and we can roll it around? Because that's you watch 1970s, 1960s, people are always carrying essentially massive boxes with handles, you know, massive, very heavy boxes with handles. Right up until like the late 90s, early 2000s.
Yeah. Oh my God, didn't they reject an idea like that in Dragon's Den? Wheels on bags, you mad?
It'll never work.
People enjoy carrying their luggage.
Yeah. It's got
something away from them.
It will fall, you know, if it'll roll downhill if you're not watching. And there goes your luggage. So do you have a pet theory? I know you were saying, you know, oh, it's great, it can be anything to anyone, but of course there's also part of the joy of that is working on your own pet theory and thinking, yeah, I think I've got the answer. And you being the expert who's written about it and read about it and podcasted over it, you must have some sort of...
I would substitute the word expert for enthusiast.
Okay.
One of the lovely things about doing this is that I've been... that other people have got in contact and got involved, and people who really are experts. And so I'm still very much just a very, very keen enthusiast. Thinking about your question. I'm stumped here.
Hi is currently boarding a rocket with the number one blasting off into space.
Not really. To be honest, that I'm equally, put it this way, you're talking to somebody who has a tape deck in their car. I'm very much of the opinion that I share it with McGowan, that we've sort of keep inventing stuff that we don't need and becoming obsessed by it and that sort of thing. So I kind of always latched onto that. And to an extent, I'd sort of, every episode that there'd be something like that, I'd sort of see that. So that was always my kind of, my interpretation of things, which I always liked.
Sort of a reaction to technological, the onrush of technological.
Yeah, there was always something slightly sinister about it, and then that it was always slightly more. It was cleverer than us, and it would start to overwhelm us and make us more. You know, there would be something nefarious about it. It wouldn't help us, even though it would be designed. We'd think, oh, this is great, I don't have to do this anymore. That there'd actually be something. We'd lose something instead. And then other people, somebody with malicious kind of intent would actually sort of somehow work that out, and it would always go a little bit wrong. So this is the kind of reason I still have videotapes. Not many.
Yeah, yeah. From the telly.
But I still got stuff I taped from the 90s, yes.
Yeah, yeah. I think I've got something upstairs. I've got quite a, I've got a box set of Hearts of Darkness and Apocalypse Now video cassettes that I've...
I've got that taped off BBC Two.
And I've got the radio... I've got the Romeo and Plus Juliet widescreen, because I remember when widescreen came in, because videos were always pan and scan, and there was, and before Blu-ray there was the widescreen section of the video HMV, which was like where the true cinephiles met. So moving away a little bit from The Prisoner, or I wanted to talk about a project that we've collaborated on, a podcast which is based on a novel I wrote called Connery, which is a speculative novel. And and this is now going to be available. We're going to be putting out episodes weekly. It's performed by Kai. It's such a funny thing listening to your own novel being sort of, it's an amazing thing. I'm going to be frank about it. It's been an absolute pleasure to sort of listen to the, as you've sent over the files, to listen to them being performed. And especially congratulations on a superb Sean Connery impersonation.
Oh, it's extremely kind of a John.
See, it's not just the shushes. It's the sort of back of the throat sort of talking. It's the bass.
It's the noises he makes. I think the main one is like the creaking cellar door, the kind of... there's a lovely bit in Last Crusade, and I think he says something like, oh, that's really good. But it's the kind of the creaking, and in the Untouchables, there's a lot of...
Why would someone say they were someone they were not?
Yeah. Who would say that who was not?
Which makes no sense because what? They're a liar, because they're criminals. What sort of policeman are you?
You're letting him off. What, you said he was from the Treasury officer? That's the first thing I'd say to get out of whatever it is you're about to arrest me for. Where are you from?
I'm from Ireland. You haggish.
I'm just a poor beat cop.
Yeah, oh, he's so good.
He was a lovely actor. I think because people, he couldn't do accents. Yeah, fine. Like people, that's what acting is.
Richard Burton never did an accent in his life. I mean, wait a second. Maybe he did. When did he do an accent? He very rarely does an accent. I mean, he's always RSC after a couple of pints. You know, Ridley Scott described Russell Crowe's accent in Gladiator.
Yes.
Which, by the way, I see a lot of Richard Burton in Gladiator. I think that's the look they were going for, was sort of Antony from Cleopatra. That era Richard Burton with the hair and everything. So I mean, this was an idea that you we both kind of had of turning it into an audiobook. I can't remember at the beginning if it was your suggestion or... But
well, I just wanted to. It was like a test thing, or for a what do you call it? My God, my mind's got black. Just a sort of a demo that I was trying to record, but I don't want to just do it. I thought I'd better ask you first.
Oh right, that's it. Yes, I remember.
And then it was like, oh, should we do some more of these? It's like, yeah, it's quite good fun. This.
Yeah.
Did I get it? It's felt like about asking you, sort of, if I've toweled your bathroom okay while you're on holiday. Was it kind of what you were after?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, it's the thing that's I think is difficult about the novel. Let me just explain for our listeners what the novel is about, and then that will help me answer that question. It's basically the story of a young boy who meets Sean Connery. Or maybe not. It's never quite sure how much of this is in the protagonist's head. And following this encounter, he's kind of inspired in different ways of different decisions he makes in his life. And he has a career which is kind of nefarious and violent and weird and darkly comic, hopefully. And so to come back to that, and then throughout his life, he meets Sean Connery at various moments. So it's a little bit of... when I was writing it, but afterwards when I sort of reread it, and I go, well, what does this remind me of as a reader? It reminded me a bit of Play It Again, Sam.
Again, Sam. Yes, the, I was going to say
the Woody Allen. Yes, exactly, the Woody Allen sort of relationship with Humphrey Bogart. True Romance does it a little bit with him meeting Elvis in the bathroom as well. Mm. It had that, but if the Woody Allen character in Play It Again, Sam was sort of more a Patrick Bateman-y kind of psychopath.
So, like Cumbrian Psycho.
Yeah, exactly. Cumbrian Psycho. There's I missed that as a subtitle. That should have been Connery, yeah, the Cumbrian Psycho. So I thought that you really got that tone, because you basically have to play... you have to play a whole range of characters, because he goes to different places. It's very sort of globetrottery. Slightly inspired by Bond. He goes to Paris on his first mission and spends some time in New York. And that's kind of supposed to be like, you know, you'd have the James Bond where he's Diamonds Are Forever takes place mainly, I mean, the book as much as the film takes place mainly in America and things like that. You'd have these very specific geographically located. There are some James Bond films which are really geographically located, actually. You know, you sort of Live and Let Die is just in Harlem, and you know,
I'm just starting to read that one now.
Oh, that's a great book as well. It's a really that's one of the more sadistic ones.
Yeah, and I just read Dr. No as well, which is remarkably similar to the book, to the film. Some of them really are. I mean, The Spy Who Loved Me is, I mean, but increasingly they just basically bought the title.
Yeah.
And that was it.
Ben McIntyre wrote a great book about Fleming, and he said that I think Spy Who Loved Me came after Goldfinger. It came after one of the more successful ones. And he said, it's just like seeing somebody in a decathlon, you know, beat the world record in the hurdles and then kill a judge with the javelin. in the next event, you know, it's such a disastrous drop in quality that it's that everybody was sort of astounded. Oh, maybe Ian Fleming is a serious novelist. Oh no. Yeah, absolutely. What attracted you to the novel because of course you would, as you say, you were doing it as a project, but you read the whole book at that point, and so
Well, it was up on Substack. I thought it was very, very funny. I know you don't want to hear the sort of praise being piled upon you.
No, I do.
John, you're a genius.
There you go. That's what it is. That the rest of this podcast will just be that on a loop.
No, it was. I just thought it was genuinely very, very funny. Very incredibly, incredibly dark at the points. But I thought you got the balance just right. And I just enjoyed reading it, really. But as a trying to do the to capture Sam Coleridge, as he's called, brilliantly, because he's so incredibly violent, just unpleasant, and you can't play him. I thought it'd be quite... You were trying to obviously go for something slightly comic, so I thought the best way to do it would be to have him play as just the nicest person in the world, you know?
Yeah.
And the way you just describe... And then you're describing these appalling things he does in a way that kind of sounds like Paddington. Not quite so, but just going for that sort of... that. If you were going to play him as some sort of... somebody who knew he was villainous... You know, people trying to play bad as bad. I always think, oh, come on.
Yeah, I mean, that's where the Patrick Bateman thing sort of falls down. It's like Patrick Bateman's an evil yuppie, even if he isn't a murderer. So it doesn't really matter, you know. Whereas this guy genuinely thinks, you know, why do I keep getting into all this hassle when I'm so, you know, when I'm trying my best to be, you know, to be nice and everyone should just get on with everyone. And
No, it was, there were lovely call, you know, as you went through it, there were callbacks to the start, and you felt that something was making more and more sense as you read it, and it was, I don't know, just thought it was really good.
I put it on Substack. That's absolutely, that was right in the very first weeks that Substack sort of came out, and I thought, oh, what could I use this for? What could I, you know, and I'm not sure how many people actually went through and read the whole thing there. The first one was got a lot of sort of clicks and whatnot, but by the end it was about 40 or 50 clicks, you know, so you're just sort of going, okay, some of these might even be people who've just clicking for the very first time and going, what's this?
Halfway through they realized it wasn't the autobiography of Sean Connery.
Well, I do worry about that, actually. When I was first sort of pitching it to as a you know, to my agent, who kind of wasn't too keen on sending it out, I have to say, hence the podcast, that it was kind of that sense that maybe calling it Connery, people would want more Connery in it. They'd want it to be a novel about Sean Connery that is sort of like Blonde for Marilyn Monroe. But I always had this idea that, well, I mean, growing up in Cumbria and being, you know, I always had this idea that I didn't live in the middle of nowhere. I had to get a bus to get to the middle of nowhere. It was like, you know, it wasn't even as central as the middle of nowhere. You know, I did have a rich fantasy life, and I just thought meeting people who were famous was so impossible. It was so unlikely that it just struck me, wouldn't it be interesting if that was, you know, a thing, if that happened, if that actually happened, or if your imagination was strong enough, you could behave like it actually happened, and that would somehow nourish you and nourish your inner life with what you needed, you know.
Was that the spark that sort of set it off when you started writing it?
Yeah, I mean, there's definitely things about Sammy that are similar to my childhood. Definitely the setting, some of the geographical locations are pretty much taken from areas around where I'm from. I hasten to add, I haven't killed anybody or any dogs or any old women in the hills or anything like that. But I would definitely, I remember as a kid, I would definitely, you know, any trip to the toilet would involve me screwing a silencer onto my gun and taking out some terrorists on the way up the stairs and rolling a grenade into the living room before I came down and machine gunning the survivors. You know, that, and to be actually perfectly frank, I still do it a little bit to this day, you know. Garrot the odd imaginary sentry.
I used to, but I don't have the knees anymore.
Well, watch Wild Geese and see how much.
I was watching Where Eagles Dare, and I know it was famously called Where Doubles Dare, wasn't
it?
Yeah,
that was Clint Eastwood's crack.
Yeah, but there were so many fantastic scenes of like this, some Richard Burton sort of abseiling down a cliff and then just dropping into shot. This quite clearly a different dimensioned man dropping into shot.
Talking about, I mean, Clint Eastwood had a, you know, he's one to talk, because if you watch the first Fistful of Dollars, there's a scene where he's sort of galloping from one sort of setup to another, and he's very obviously not only not Clint Eastwood, he's not wearing a hat and he's got like an afro. It's just really, it's like the worst possible double ever. It's just like guy on horse, he'll do, you know. There's another Richard Burton film called Breakthrough, which was have you seen that with Lee Marvin?
Is that the one where he's a German soldier? Yeah,
yeah.
Like 1980.
Yeah, and it's an unofficial sequel to Cross of Iron, Sam Peckinpah's Cross of Iron. He's got the same name as James Coburn's character in Cross of Iron. And it's just absolutely... He's so old, and he's so obviously got a bad back. I mean, like, in every action scene, you can see he's got a bad back.
Yes.
It's like, has he been shot? Oh, no, he's just got a bad back.
If he has to do anything more than pick up a pen off the floor, they call him a stuntman.
You can see him wince as he moves a piece of paper across the table, you know. As he lights a cigarette, it's like, oh, ow. God damn
it. Even his hand with the lighter.
Yeah. It's obviously a fake hand. This comes up.
can't raise it, old boy. Sorry.
Yeah.
Right. Quite close up here. It was amazing, some of those actors. We talk about this with the prisoner, these actors. Like, my God, he must be about 65 there. And you look him up and he was 38.
Yeah. Yeah.
Connery in Diamonds Are Forever, he was 40.
Yeah, yeah.
What?
I'm 10 years older than Connery was in Diamonds Are Forever. And I don't look anywhere near as old as he looks in that film.
No, my God, he just decided, I don't have to try, I don't have to stop anything and eat whatever I like now. And I kind of, just in those times, he kind of, His Bond films, he aged so rapidly throughout those five. Or, yeah, you know, what is it, five or six? Six initially, wasn't it?
Six, because then he came back for... Oh, no, he came back for...
He skipped 1969, didn't he? So yeah, it was a bit of a two-year gap. But he... and then, of course, poor Richard Burton, you think, well, look at him. Well, he's 75. Of course he's going to be... No, he's not.
No.
But... Yeah. I suppose none of us, I don't suppose anyone drinks that kind of quantity of scotch now as was standard back then, you know. Trevor,
I mean,
Howard,
he was on two or three packets of cigarettes a day as well. I mean, he was puffing away from cigarettes all the time.
Got my oath.
Yeah. I mean, he's just the best. He's my favorite actor, I think. Burton and Connery are the two actors I come back to time and time again.
Yeah. Connery, I was thinking, because do you know what? There was obviously you're a Robin and Marion fan.
Mm, yeah, Richard Lester. Yeah.
Because one of the other things when you're doing Sean Connery, you suddenly have to just imbue yourself with as much kind of masculinity as you can possibly inject into yourself, because that's kind of what he is. That's kind of, but watching Robin and Marion, there's such a lovely scene where he's talking to her, having rescued her. And he just says, it's just a simple line. He says, "You're so beautiful." Mm. And his eyes, his puppy, he just turns into a puppy.
Mm.
And he could do all these different things. As I say, he's such a much, much better actor than people take him for. They just think he's this big star.
Mm.
But a lovely, lovely actor, I thought.
Mm. I think the same thing's true of Michael Caine to some degree, that people, for years and years, there was this idea that Michael Caine was wooden. And always played Michael Caine, and then no, he does so many daring things, you know.
That's very kind of you. Sorry about this, listeners. I've been offered appetizers.
Oh, lovely! Oh, lovely! Yes, appetizers.
Rice on Film will now become temporarily the cooking show.
Yeah. Well, we were talking about recipes before we started recording. We should have just included all of that.
We should actually. The Rice on Film for now on should end with a recipe.
Go on. Give us a recipe, because you of course have a wonderful restaurant in North Wales.
Well, this is true. Yes, I would.
500 meters from this cinema.
As the crackling noise as the advert ends.
Westless is available in the foyer.
In the interval, you'll be able to buy King Cones.
If you're drinking Bacardi. Do you remember that?
The dog and duck down the high street.
Catching the last bus home.
You think, hang on, I was 10 when I first saw this advert in the cinema. I'm 19 now. Surely other people are paying for adverts.
Yeah. Yes.
Is it Ray Brooks?
Do you have a recipe for us?
Oh, I'm trying to think. There's actually a recipe for a posset in our prisoner book, which was rather nice.
What's a posset when it's at home?
A posset, sir. It's a sort of a cream based, slightly meaty affair. Sort of cream and a touch of honey, and then you sort of drink that as a sort of I think it was the kind of thing they drank before Horlicks was invented.
Ah, I see. Right. So old.
Had a sort of you know, a soporific quality to it.
Mm.
It's also a nice set dessert. Goes well with if you infuse it with lavender.
There you go.
There you are, listeners.
There you go, listeners. We've the first ever recipe. And by the way, that links to our Columbo chat earlier because you bought me and sent me Cooking with Columbo.
Ah, yes. Have you done anything from me yet?
The lavishly, yes. I think I did the chili.
Yes, Johnny Cash's chili recipe.
Exactly.
Amazing.
Yes. The lavishly illustrated, by which I mean there are photos of food that look like car accidents in there. It's a little bit like if you look up Vincent Price and cookery, I mean, bless his heart, he's trying, but the photographs aren't exactly appetizing.
That's the thing with any book from the cookery from the 70s. What was that camera, the film stock they used that made everything look? Everything looked like it was set in aspic.
Yeah, exactly. That's exactly
I think everything was set in aspic.
That might have been aspic. I think the cause of that was aspic more than anything else.
I know. It was the foolishly somebody invented at exactly the same time aspic and the ring mold, which meant that every single 70s dinner party would have something set in red jelly, usually some prawns or something. God, we were lucky to dodge that.
Often those paper cuffs that they put around the legs of chickens and
lamb cutlets on the
little paper, just in case you want to pretend they've got cuffs and cufflinks and whatnot. I remember my mum, 1978, making the first spaghetti bolognese in Cumbria, I think, and shocking and impressing her friends in equal measure. I'm not eating any of that foreign muck.
It's disgusting. Look at that.
Absolutely.
Oh, God.
Oh, brilliant. Okay. Go ahead, Kai.
No, I was going to say, a while back, we had a bit of a sort of 70s party once, and we were trying to eat some of this makeup, cook up some of the stuff that we used to eat when we were kids that was amazing, like Angel Delight and stuff like that. And to a man, every single recipe was just disgusting. My God. I don't know if they've changed everything. But, I mean, I remember just, I could just squeeze kind of bags of Angel Delight into my mouth all day. I would have been a happy child. It was God almighty.
I used to eat raw jelly.
Oh, yeah.
You remember you used to get cubes of jelly? I just used to eat them like that without making them into jelly.
Oh, yeah.
And that was...
Toast. We did it instead of we were making some appetizers like toast with toast toppers. Do you remember that stuff?
Oh yeah. It was a kind of weird grey green mush.
It was And I mean to steal a line from somebody else, it looked like somebody had tried to invent vomit without the aid of a human stomach, and then it was mass produced and just put on toast. Maybe I think he put it on toast, then he grilled it.
Oh, God, Lord.
It was from the same devious minds that brought you sandwich spread.
I know.
This recipe section's taken a terrible turn.
I know. I remember going to Quicksave to buy vodka, and the cheap vodka, when I got it home, I looked at it, and it was too cheap to be called vodka, and it was called Tolstoy Spirit Drink. And it was like,
4%.
94% or something.
I know, it wouldn't even strip paint.
Yeah. Oh God, Lord. Brilliant, Kai. I think we've encouraged everybody to go forth and revisit the 70s and the May 1967. So the book is called Free for All and named after the podcast, which
indeed.
Which is also called Free for All. I'll put links In the show notes, and I'll put links to our new podcast, Connery, which is the first episode is already up, and the second episode is due up this week as well. So hope everybody who listens to this will give it a shot. And thanks very much for coming on.
My pleasure. Thank you very much indeed. Bon appetit.
Grazie.
Happy seeing you.
Grazie tanto. Oh, that's I should have to say something now, shouldn't I? Is there a stock reply that I have
to be seeing you?
Yeah.
No, the simplest.
I just shout and slam a door or something. turn around in my chair.
Just very quickly inflate a huge white balloon and throw it at me.
Okay, there you go. Take care, Kai. Lovely talking.
You too. Good night.
Deserves the best, and there's no better place to shop for Mother's Day than Whole Foods Market. They're your destination for unbeatable savings, from premium gifts to show-stopping flowers and irresistible desserts. Start by saving 33% with Prime on all body care and candles. Then get a 15-stem bunch of tulips for just $9.99 each with Prime. Round out Mom's menu with festive rosé, irresistible berry chantilly cake, and more special treats. Come celebrate Mother's Day at Whole Foods Market.
Hey, it's Danny Pellegrino from Everything Iconic. Ready to upgrade your style game without blowing your budget? Check out Quince. They've got all the good stuff, shirts and polos, activewear and fine leather goods, all at 50 to 80% less than other high-end brands. And the best part? They're all about safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get that luxury vibe without the luxury price tag. Hit up quince.com/upgrade for free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. That's quince.com/upgrade.